You are listening to the Glass Cannon Network, the premier source for role-playing game entertainment. Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Network.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to Cannon Fodder. It is Wednesday, March 6th, 2024, and I'm your old pal, Joe O'Brien.
And I'm Troy. If you're watching the video, this is my sleeping baby, LaValle.
Oh, look at her little sleepy
head. Isn't she cute? She's so sleepy. She's teething. It's always fun, man.
Oh, that's super fun.
Yeah.
Incredible pain, and a baby can't explain it, and they get fevers,
and
they
and
you know what else is great about teething? It really hits in the middle of the night.
Yes,
always. That's when the teeth really like coming through.
Right, you just
not at noon. Let's not at 1 p.m.
Let's administer Tylenol in the dark, everybody.
So you're telling me you're on low sleep.
I'm a little low sleep, but you know, lately I was on a good sleep zone for a while. I was like going to sleep, and I never really sleep through the night. We've talked about this on shows before. It baffles me that there are people like, time to go to bed, and then wake up like,
oh glad my alarm went off. Right? I would have overslept. Could you imagine that?
It's just crazy to me. But like lately, for the past few weeks, I've been having this issue where I wake up and I'm up for an hour and a half, just awake. And I'm not walking around. I probably should. They say if you're like, can't go to sleep, just get up and fuck around. But like, I'll wake up, and it's not at a time like, if it was 4:30, I think I'd be like, you know what? Let's just start the day. Then I'll really go to sleep tonight. But it's at like 2:33, and I'm not Mark Wahlberg where I can just hit the gym at that time. So I'm up and I'm just like, huh, guess my mind's got a lot going on. But this has been going on for like 3 weeks. So throw some teething onto that.
Lovely.
And I'm just getting over strep throat. It's been a fun couple weeks, buddy.
Well, you know what? I'm not really interested in your excuses, because I need you to bring your A game. This is about to be a hot fod, dude.
Dude, I got this.
This is going to be a good fod.
I got some Glass Cannon coffee. You know we roast our own beans now?
You got some of them Glass Cannon beans, dude?
I want to start offering food and liquid products in the store, because I'm sure that won't be a headache. I want to like have our own coffee, our own beer, our own, I don't know, chocolates.
Yeah, let's bring a whole bunch of perishables over the border to Canada. I think that's going to go well, too.
I think that's allowed.
We're already struggling to bring a t-shirt of a creepy bird across the border.
Dude, I'm going to have to sneak cheese curds out of there. I don't like it.
What's going on, everybody? We got a great FOD set for you today. We're going to be quick in the news section. I'm tired of news. I want to get rid of it. I want to get rid of news.
That's the only reason I still do this show, is
get
to
through it.
Deliver news.
And I want to talk about the Glass Cannon podcast episode, campaign 2, episode 24. This was 24, right? It was 25. I think it's 24. And then, of course, a nice little We Are Stupid, where we're going to get into some high-level GM stuff and listener mail, of course. Nice, chunky, chunky listener mail. So, hit us with the news, Troy. What is on the top of your mind today? It's probably the tour, I would imagine.
Yeah, tour is
always
still,
thinking about the tour.
I'm always thinking about the tour. You know, it's funny because like one of the reasons that we relaunched Cannon Fodder this way was, and we've mentioned this before, is like it's so hard to disseminate what's going on to the niche to our listeners. And so by putting it on the FOD, we hope that most people listen to it. Now, less people listen to the FOD than listen to the main show. But the problem is, I feel like the only way to really lock it in is to have a portion of the main show also go over this news. But then between like thanking the sponsors and the banter and everything, now it's a half an hour into the show before we get to everything. You know, we used to do an intro to the show, and the whole point of the intro, while also being able to keep things current, was to let people know like, hey, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're doing this. Check out this. Be sure to look at our Tumblr. But now it's like,
sign up for the Tumblr.
Get on our MySpace. But now it's like there's still no good way of doing it, and I'm trying to navigate that. But
you can do it in the main show as long as you are ahead enough on the news, which is always hard to do, and as long as you just keep it tight.
I got
to
keep it tight.
Your problem is you're verbose, and we all jump on it, and we all like to have a good time talking about whatever it is. It's like, just keep the news to 60 seconds or 2 minutes, and you'll be fine.
All right, I can do that. Well, you know, we're coming to Toronto next week. Joe and I were just talking like, holy shit, that's next week. That's insanity. It's sold out. But then we're going to Kansas City and Austin. Tickets are doing very well, especially for Austin. Austin is the hottest show next to Toronto on the tour. Vancouver is selling really well. St. Paul, I think they're going to sell it out this year, dude. They were cooking over the weekend.
Oh, love me some St. Paul peeps.
Then it goes to Denver and Nashville. Denver, I don't know what's going on. But here's what's going to happen. You don't sell out Denver. We're not going to come back for like 3 or 4 years. I was on the fence about coming back and seeing the paltry rush to the ticket site.
Well, we sold out Boulder, didn't we?
We did sell out Boulder.
And Boulder was great. Where are all those Boulder people?
Where are my Boulder peeps at?
Where are my Boulder peeps
at? I should see if it's the same promoter because we could like email them directly. But anyways, Denver, you got to get your shit together. And then Nashville, obviously, I spent a lot of time this weekend thinking about the Nashville retreat, which, as we mentioned, is sold out. Really, really excited about that. Kind of like now it's like really getting into like how are we going to make this the best weekend ever? And what I really want to do is like connect directly with the people who purchase the packages and create a perfect weekend for them. Get direct feedback from the customers to find out like, what do you expect for a weekend like this? What would make a perfect weekend for you? And kind of build the weekend around that based on the things that we're excited about. And I had a couple breakthroughs this weekend. I'm really, really pumped about it. I think I'm going to have like a Discord chat with everybody because we set up a Discord role just for the people that purchase Nashville packages. So I think I'm going to like set up a chat in there and be like, let's talk. What do you guys like? And do a little Q&A. anyways, I'm excited about that. Mentioned Toronto is next week. With this Wednesday. So right now, if you're listening to this, if you are still on Patreon and have not made the switch to Supercast, it honestly might be too late. I think that I know today is the last day, but I don't know if it clicks over at midnight or at the end of the day. You have to follow the link. We've sent several messages. You have to follow the link to transfer your Patreon to the new subscription service. If you want to lock in your Patreon prices after today, that option is gone. Hell, it might already be gone. In which case, you can sign up for the 30-day free trial, which is also available. And then, but if you want to lock in those prices, if you want to have, you know, what you've already paid for be carried over, to the new service, you got to do it, by today. Very, very important. That's enough news. That was over 60 seconds.
That's enough news. Yeah, you kept it tight. That was most of the things on my list, except, but Helldivers is back. I told you I wanted to make this happen, and we're making it happen. It's today. It's today, actually.
Today.
So if you're listening to this Wednesday, March 6th, as this episode releases, clear your schedule. We're doing a happy hour stream, dude. 4 p.m. Ooh. Eastern today. Exactly. Little top. You know, Paula, man, she gets after that cocaine.
That's the only way she knows how to play.
No, I'm so excited to play again, playing with Paula, Mary Lou, and Sydney. A super squad for Super Earth. And we are going to be dropping in Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/theglasscannon.
Awesome.
Come out, hang out with us live. It's going to be so much fun. We did it 2 weeks ago. We had an absolute blast. And we're bringing it back this Wednesday, today. So a little later today. So it's Wednesday, March 6th. If you're listening to this later, you can go back and check out the VOD.
That's awesome, dude. And tomorrow I'll be playing Baldur's Gate 3, and I'm pretty sure we'll be in Act 3. I've been like,
you've been burning.
My wife had a couple nights out last week, and I just was like, all right, honey, see ya. Put the kids to bed. Manhattan, side beer. Let's go. I am like, I'm at the climax of Act 2 right now, and it is awesome.
That's great.
So yeah, I'll probably be starting Act 3 this week.
All right, great. Let's get into the Glass Cannon podcast.
Love that show.
So fantastic episode this week, I felt. You know, it's one of those ones that's got a little bit of everything. You've got, you know, mystery reveals, mystery new questions being asked, and then a juicy combat in a cool set piece. I loved it top to bottom. So let's talk about... All right, first question I'm going to fire out at you.
Okay.
Who is Kanipo, and why is he doing this?
Well, I'll tell you what I was most interested in, which was listening to you guys try to figure it out.
Yeah.
That was really cool. And I think that the listeners were way into it too, because there are people who've read the book. There are people who haven't. There are people who are like exactly like you, just taking this information and trying to suss it out. And so listening to you guys formulate your opinions was so, so interesting. And I'm sure if it was interesting to me, it was interesting to others.
And it was even more interesting to me on the re-listen that I did, because, you know, there's a lot going on there. You got five players talking, in some cases over each other, as ideas are like, as people are excited about ideas. And some things were lost to me in the moment that I didn't hear, and that I heard on the re-listen. I'm like, okay. And I'm trying to like take all this in to try to put this mystery together. And it's tough having you on here because you're, you know, it's just tough. Like I can't interview you about the plot, you know, which is kind of silly. And that's really the bulk of this episode. Yeah. We'll get to the combat in a second. I got to get more other people on fodder, especially people on the Glass Cannon podcast, just to talk about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because we can actually hash out what we're thinking. And I'm not, you know, bullshitting with somebody who knows all the answers and isn't telling me. So, but anyway, I found it fascinating. I loved the discussion, and I like I certainly like the mystery where it is now, especially in this episode where you have the reveal of the painting that's being worked on. It's a very cool element. I mean, I know this from Delta Green, from Impossible Landscapes, no spoilers, but season 4 of Get in the Trunk, when we start Impossible Landscapes, like, there is a canvas with a thing over it. And it's just that moment of lifting it up. What's there? What is this crazy person working on? Is such a thrilling and exciting kind of horror mystery trope.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's really bringing forth this idea of the successor, right? Or the idea that Kinipo is expiring or in some way. And we still don't have any answers as to where that goes, of course. But now that we know more about the mystery than we did even 3 weeks ago, and we're really kind of sinking our teeth into a horrifying mystery, right? You're talking about trying to essentially track down an inhuman serial killer of some kind. It's very, very scary, and it's very mind-blowing to try to figure out what this creature even is. You know, like Giant Slayer, I love Giant Slayer. I will always love Giant Slayer because call me simple. I know you do often.
You're very simple.
But I like a good, strong, understandable framework of a plot that has great depth, where you can create great depth within the framework.
Yeah.
With the kind of thing that we're dealing with now, one of my issues is like, we don't even have a framework. Like, there's nothing to work within, and it's very nebulous and hard to kind of start putting things together. So, my question for you is, now that we know a little bit more, you've spoken in vagaries about this before, but I'm curious if you can give me a little bit more of a juicier answer now. What drew you to this AP as the AP for Campaign 2?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I want to be able to answer that in less cryptic terms than the adventure itself. But like, when I started reading it, I liked that it opened with a mystery, because I think that was one of the things that really helped Giant Slayer. Is like, you basically, it's a murder mystery to begin with, and then you very quickly realize there's a lot more going on. And so I liked that we started with that not only did we start with a mystery, but there is a overall, like, what happened here? There was like a world event that directly affected the characters. And so the fact that we started with a mini mystery that may or may not be connected to the mystery of the characters, but the characters themselves have this like desire to figure out what happened to them. That to me was very, very, very interesting. And then as I continued to read book one and scan through book one, because the first thing I do is like, I don't just like page one, I read it. I scan through, I look at the pictures, and I kind of get the sense of like what's happening. And as I'm looking through book one in particular, I was like, oh, now that's really interesting. I've never seen that before. I'm curious where that goes, because that's never been done on the network and is really, really interesting, but it could also be shitty. Let me read. Let me keep going. And so I finally got book two and saw where the payoff was.
Wait, so what you're talking about right now, we have not seen yet?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just some really, I don't want to say you're close or you're far away, but like, there's just a really interesting thing that happens. I'm already saying too much, I feel like. But it's just, to me, I was like, whew. If we can pull this off, I think it'll be really, really cool, especially considering the history of the network.
Is it high risk? Could it flop?
I don't think so. Not in our hands. But we're just too good. But I definitely had concerns. I was like, I don't know if I want to go this way, but I think the way that it's handled and the way that it's important to what is going on, is going to make it really sing. And also it advances the plot in such an interesting way. I don't know. And as I continued to read, I just really liked how this is so wildly different from Giant Slayer, because I didn't want to do just another Giant Slayer. And I also didn't want to do a Strange Aeons or a Strange Aeons or a Ruins or Rise of the Rune Lords. To me, this just felt like a very unique, weird, different adventure. That's why I liked it.
Cool. What would you say? Again, it's tough. I just feel like, maybe from your perspective, we know nothing. You know nothing, Jon Snow, you know. But I feel like we know a lot more than when we started Gatewalkers, absolutely, right? In terms of what this AP what kind of themes it's putting out there. So I'm curious if there's anything at this early stage that you would advise a GM who was thinking of running Gatewalkers at home, like anything you would advise them to do to prepare to run this mystery. Is there anything that you've done to help you prepare this mystery a little bit better? Obviously, we talked about how you did the investigation scenes with much more role play than the way that it is presented in the book, the way that it could be done at some tables. But is there anything else? Is there any other media you drew on? Is there any other, resources you looked to help put your head in the right space for this mystery?
I wish I could give you like a real cool answer. But no, the only thing that has helped is 8 years and thousands of hours of doing this. That's what's helped. I feel like the time that we've spent doing this, the time that I've spent behind the screen preparing these things and getting to kind of figure out this art form of podcasting actual plays, like that's really what's prepared me for this, because it's made my job a lot easier along the way. I'm at the point now where I really feel like I'm able to do less prep, and that makes me happier to play. But there's no media. I mean, I don't watch anything. I really don't watch anything. All the books I read are books on like nothing to do with fantasy.
That's fine. Let me rephrase then. Is there anything you would have changed about how you presented the mystery from the top? Or do you feel like, you know, cause you're not prepping a lot. You're doing this a lot on the fly, a lot of improv. Would you have done anything different? Would you have presented something in a different way? Would you have not shown Kenipo in that scene yet? Would you have, you know what I mean? Like, I'm curious if you feel like every way you've approached this mystery as a GM is perfect.
No, it's certainly not perfect. I don't know. I mean, I think I always think about the beginning, like, would have I have done something differently? And I just don't think I would have. Like, I'm not really interested. And I thought about it, like having you guys start in Ustalav with Riddleston or coming to Riddleston, you know, it would have been 4 episodes before we got to Seven Arches if we did all that. And, you know, we've joked around the table that maybe we'll do a flashback of you guys getting to meet each other and see how that works out. But like, to me, it just felt like one of the things that when The Wire was all the rage, and I don't know how true this was. I think it became sort of a rumor that had a certain amount of truth to it. But like, what made The Wire so different for television, I always
apocryphal,
heard.
Apocryphal, is that the term?
Is that the
right term?
Why The Wire was so different and so like eye-opening is that they didn't hire traditional screenwriters and TV writers to be the writers on the show. They hired a lot of authors, like book authors. And so the pacing of the show moved unlike anything else on television, because it felt like, you know, it was just written in a new style. It wasn't written in that same cinematic style.
And weren't there also like wasn't the showrunner like a journalist? Like,
yeah, David Simon he was, let's see.
I feel like he was like,
yeah,
a
he worked
beat
for
reporter.
The Baltimore Sun.
Yeah.
And he wrote books. Yeah. Like his jam was journalism and like crime true crime novels and stuff. And so I think he brought together a staff of people like that. If not, like certainly the guy behind it, like his training wasn't in screenwriting. His training was in journalism. And so I think one of the things that I like about this is it's unfolding more like a novel, and it unfolds at a different pace than sort of the more cinematic stuff that we've done in the past. Now, we still have our big cliffies and we still have plenty of cinematic moments, but the way the mystery unfolds, the sort of core plot, to me is straight out of a novel. We're 25 episodes in. You guys still have no idea how any of this connects to the missing moment. Like, and maybe that's a problem. I don't think so. I think it's like, just live with these characters right now. They're here on Riddleson's orders to try and figure out if there is any connection to what happened at Seven Arches is connected to the missing moment. The obnubulate curse being lifted, is that at all connected to the missing moment? And so that's what you're here to investigate. And now as you're investigating that, you got wrapped up in this other mystery and you're not even talking about the missing moment, but you know that you're here because Riddleson saw a connection. So hopefully that connection will be revealed, and it may take a long time for you to see what that connection is, but I kind of
like
that. Is
it going to be revealed in book one?
I cannot say.
I refuse. Can't or won't?
Won't.
At least you answered that honestly.
I also don't remember.
I also don't remember. All right, let's get back to the stuff we can talk about. Let's talk about this Djiriak. Am I saying that right?
Djiriak.
This Djiriak this resident. By the way, is Djiriak a creature type? Or is that the creature's name?
It's a race. Yeah. It's a Djiriaks are a race from the Shadow Plane. D'apostrophe Z-I-R-I-A-K.
Ooh, did I spell that wrong? Okay. I had no idea how to begin spelling that. Okay. So the Djiriak is, I said something like this in the show, and everybody looked at me like I was crazy for a second.
Cause you couldn't think of the word. And when I was watching the dailies, I was like, you meant to say Sheeran.
Sheeran. Yeah. That was it.
Yeah. It's kind of reminded you of the,
yeah,
the
I mean,
Starfinder,
like, we're talking
Sheeran.
About insectoid four-armed telepaths.
Yeah.
That's what they are. So like, how is there no connection here? This isn't mentioned at all in the AP. They don't mention it at all.
No, they're from the Shadow Plane. They're from actually Shadow Absalom.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and they speak their own language, which is Djiriak, but they prefer to speak telepathically because they don't want to hurt their vocal cords. Yeah, I mean, it's very, I think it's just the reason there's no connection, the direct connection to Sheeran is like in science fantasy, like insectoids communicate telepathically. What isn't like Ender's Game?
Hive minds.
Yeah, Ender's Game, they all like,
yeah.
Don't they like, that's why they're so hard to defeat, is because they all can just like blink and they all know what the other person's thinking.
Yeah, yeah. And well, that jumped right out at me. These Djiriaks, are they all multicolored? Is that part of the like racial description in
the
general,
runes,
or was that this one, was he painted? Okay.
Yeah, no, the runes are all multicolored, and that's what gives them that ability to blast the light. You know, I don't know if they're all multicolored or if that was just for this paint, but the light
had
and
some
the
flare.
Yeah, the runes are very, very important.
Is there any story behind this creature that you want to share with us?
I mean, there is.
I mean, I guess it's a little early, but I mean,
I'll tell you what, there's a world where you don't take this creature out and you learn things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like, this is my question. It's not even quite, we've talked about this before on fodder. I don't need to go on, I don't need to go over and over it, but like, as a player and as a game master, I want to question everybody. Like, I don't like kicking down doors and murdering people immediately. Some people enjoy that because they just know it's going to end up that way anyway. So let's just get this over with. And some people obviously could be very well role playing. You know what I mean? They're like, they attacked us. We are defending ourselves, you know. But to me, taking a few extra steps or extra rounds to restrain someone that is could have valuable information is super important. But I also don't want to be that guy at the table that's like, a broken record, right? Where it's like, we're not going to end every fight with a restraint check. Would you just let us kill people? So I just don't know where to draw that line.
Well, I'll tell you, the way that most of these are written is like 99% of the enemies, it'll say right in the thing, it's like they fight until death.
Fight
because of
death.
This, that, and that, they fight to the death. Some of them, like in the case of this creature, is like, will surrender at X amount of hit points or half that. Once they're below half, they will surrender because like their life is more important than the cause that they're fighting for. And so normally if it comes back around to my turn and you have me up, but at that threshold, I'll go along with the stat block. Sometimes I won't because I don't feel like role playing, or like sometimes it's close enough. And I'll be like, all right, let's talk it out. In this case, you guys just blasted it and there was no chance. And so to me, I was like, okay, just like when you walk by treasure, which you guys also have done already. It's like part of me is like, come on, get that treasure. But you walk by it, I give you the extra check. You got anybody else want to do anything in here? No. All right. It's the same thing. You walk by the treasure. You walk by the opportunity to learn a couple things. I don't think it's game breaking stuff either way.
Yeah. I feel like when you come across, when you do a recall knowledge check and you know that this creature is intelligent and you know that they are in the middle of a library in the home of your enemy, it's kind of like, why would you not ask this person questions? Now, you know, it went quick. It was just, you know, we lashed out, burned them down. But I don't know. I don't want to be a broken record at the table. Like, come on, guys, let's interrogate. But I do think it's important to get us more information. Otherwise, we keep grasping at straws in the dark.
Yeah, but also, like, I think I'm pretty good about, like, giving you guys information even post-mortem you start searching the room, you find scraps of paper and books or journals. Like, yeah. I do that a lot so that, like, if I'm like, I feel like this guy knew something, I'm gonna lead you there one way or another.
What's your gut instinct as a player in these cases? Do you like to just fire, all systems go, take people out? I don't feel like talking to this guy. Or do you generally speaking like to try to interrogate enemies or even just let them go in exchange for information?
I kind of metagame with the game master to see, like, does the game master want me? Is the game master at all hinting that, like, there might be information here? Are they tipping their hand? Because some GMs will be pretty clear in just little things that they do that, like, there might be something more here.
They might have them talk during the combat at some point or another.
I'm not a big talk during combat guy because I try to think it's happening in 6 seconds. You know what I mean? Like, you don't really have time to get into, let me tell you something about the history of this AP.
Well, no, but I'm saying literally, combat. Even if you said anything, even if you blurted, like, not surrendering necessarily, but blurted, like, you don't even understand what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah. That definitely,
like, in one line, and that it makes people like, so little things like that are kind of cool ways to clue the players in that maybe they could benefit from not murder hoboing this particular person.
Yeah.
Any abilities on the Djirik that we didn't see because we burned it down so quick? Any fun stuff on that creature? I've never fought one of these before.
Yeah. Let me see here. So. I loved I find that a lot of creatures have this ability to do like two attacks with one action and then the map doesn't hit until they want to do a third attack. So obviously a four-armed creature had that. That ended up being pretty brutal. Dazzling Burst is pretty cool. It's just like, it's one of those abilities that, it says after using this ability, the Djirik loses its glow for 24 hours. During this time, it can't use Dazzling Burst again. A creature that attempts this save is immune to all Dazzling Bursts for 1 minute. So pretty much it had the ability to do that. And I knew I wanted to start the combat with that, see if I could catch anybody within it. But then all it can do is just kind of maul.
Yeah.
And if a bunch of you save, it's going to be a cakewalk thing. Sometimes in those instances, I look at the stat blocks and I think, okay, well, I've got to adjust for 5 party members here. Maybe my Djirik can do that twice a day. Now, I don't think I've done that yet this adventure, but like that's the type of stuff that like I'm totally fine with doing. And I know the purists don't like it when I do that or assume that I made a mistake. But like when you're balancing for 5 players, you sometimes you got to kind of bebop and scat a little bit and see, like, I want to make this encounter. I don't need to make every encounter impossible, but I try to make every encounter interesting. Although sometimes I'm fine with you just stomping. And if it throws out a dazzling burst and all of you immediately save, all it's going to do is claw for five rounds until it's eventually dead, I might be like, well, this Dzhiriak can do it again. In this case, I didn't do that.
Wink at the camera.
Let me tell you why. He's got a whole backstory why he can do this to us. I haven't done that yet, but like those are the things that I think about in the moment. I'm like, you know, as I try to give people more things, like the cloak on the fucking centaur. That ability was like a once per day ability, and I did it a couple times because it was like
seven.
Fucking,
I think it was seven times.
Did I do it seven times? It's like, this is not game breaking. It's just going to make things a little more interesting. But you know, these are little adjustments that I make. If I was playing with four PCs, I really would just like keep it by the book, unless I thought something was really, really wrong. But for five PCs, you got to just kind of do little.
So you're going to punish us for having friends.
Yes.
Having more friends.
Are there five of you?
There's five of us.
Yeah. We're cooking through this AP, man.
Are we really?
We'll be on campaign three before you know it.
Because of the TPK? A little preview of listener mail. All right, let's get to We Are Stupid. It's actually a pretty clean app, pretty clean fight. It was tight. It was fast. Really not much here to talk about, but in terms of mistakes. But nonetheless, we got to do a little We Are Stupid. And Nicholas A. Lowe hooked it up. Sing us in, Nick.
What?
We are stupid.
Announcing us in that we indeed are stupid.
It sounded like he left the garage band like metronome on.
Tick, 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 tick.
Nick Lowe coming in with these drops, dude.
Coming in with these drops.
He does this out of the goodness of his heart.
As if he doesn't have enough to do, right? I mean, for God's sakes. All right, Professor Eric, I want to thank every once in a while, I got to take a moment. I got to look at the camera and I got to say, thank you, Professor Eric.
Speaking of goodness of
putting
their
heart. In the work that you put in on this, it is so incredibly appreciated. And today is a perfect example of why. There is not a lot of just rules mistakes here to get out, but there's a lot of really thoughtful things that he has put forth in this assessment of this episode. One of which is he's like, hey, how about giving Paizo a little plug? I'm like, okay, centaurs have been announced as a playable ancestry in Howl of the Wild coming in May. So
fucking wild.
Yeah, it's so wild. So we brought it up on this episode. I didn't know about it. I had missed that particular one. I had heard of Howl of the Wild, but I had no idea that centaurs were going to be a playable ancestry in that. So thank you for that heads up. Keep an eye out for that. Okay, so the Dzhiriak crit, you know this. And we might have discussed this in the episode. I forget. Did we mention in the episode that we should not have pulled a fan crit by our own rules on the Dzhiriak?
Yeah, sometimes we get so fired up, like no one at the table says, wait a minute. And that's what happened here. It was not a nat 20.
I missed it completely.
And I was like, named character, let's go.
Exactly.
And everybody's like, go.
Yeah. So just for the record, it was not a natural 20, right? And we pulled a fan crit. That was just a We Are Stupid moment. It's a brief mistake.
It's fun. I always like when it's in my favor.
Yeah, exactly. all right. So dimensional assault. Let's take it to the dimensional assault. I'm going to present here. I'm going to share screen. Let's take it to dimensional assault. This is the ability that Sydney used as Asta when she was able to tumble through a space, wow, making a short dimensional hop to better position yourself for an attack. It came up in the show because you said, does that provoke an attack of opportunity? She said, I don't know. You said, it does, but it doesn't matter because my creature doesn't have one. I'm just busting your chops.
Only
go ahead, do your jaunt. Professor Eric points out this does not provoke an attack of opportunity because it only has a verbal component. Bam, you can see it right there. Thank you, Demiplane.
When I say it does, I'm just saying because I know Sydney doesn't know. So I'm like, well, it's a spell, so it does. So like we just got to the real question should have been like, does that spell have somatic or
the manipulate trait?
Yeah, manipulate trait.
The traits on dimensional assault: uncommon, conjuration, magus, and teleportation. No manipulate John on that.
It makes sense. Like, that would be, that would really hamstring that ability if it would provoke.
It's meant to be used in melee, yeah. You know, really.
And it's so, really fucking cool. Dude, I'm using Misty Step left and right in Baldur's Gate, and that's kind of what it is. Like, you just position yourself perfectly.
Dude, it's incredibly cool. Did you also realize, now I put out a message to Professor Eric prior to the recording of this. Oh, he did get back to me just now live while we're on the air. Oh my gosh. Amazing. I followed up on the dimensional assault because I was like, there's something that is, I feel like is a little strange here. And I wanted to double check with him. So he writes back. Yeah, exactly. Let's see. You forego the strike. Okay. So this is awesome, but tricky. All right. Oh, man. This is going to get ugly. Here we go.
I don't like it.
You tumble through a space, making a short dimensional hop to better position yourself for an attack. Now, watch this, Troy. Teleport to any square in range that's within reach of a creature. So you must land within reach of a creature. And then make a melee strike against a creature within your reach.
So you get the movement and the attack all as part of one action.
All as part of one action. Now,
how did we do it?
I don't think she took the attack, but let's not worry about that for now. Let's think about going forward, okay?
Yeah.
The other key component to this is that it recharges spell strike for a magus of Sydney's type, of Asta's type. So, remember we talked about you can do a spell strike, but then you need to spend an action to recharge your spell strike to recenter yourself in order to be able to do it again. You have to do that, but there are some spells for your specific, whatever it is, bloodline. It's not a bloodline, but your specific kind of magus that if you cast this certain kind of focus spell, it acts as the recharge for you. So you can cast a spell and it also recharges your spell strike. Dimensional Assault does that for Sydney, which is awesome. This is what I wrote Professor Eric about. I said, hold on a second though. Isn't this a little bit weird? If you use your dimensional, let's say you use a spell strike last turn. This turn, you're going to use Dimensional Assault as your first action in order to set up a two action spell strike after it, because it recharges your spell strike. Professor Eric says that Dimensional Assault effectively is one action for three actions. It is a move action, an attack, and a recharge of a spell strike, all in one action, which is really neat. But what I said was, if you jump and then make a melee strike, wouldn't you not want to make that melee strike? Because then when you do your spell strike, it has the map. So you're doing a map attack when you have your spell all boosted up and in there.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you not want to use that? And so he just got back to me and he said, in general, people don't use their, in his experience, people don't use their focus spell to recharge spell strike on the same turn that they're going to use spell strike. They use it at the end of a turn, for example, in order to set it up for next time so that you don't have, so you're not suffering from that map.
So you basically take your highest map on Dimensional Assault is like the normal way of doing it because it's a bonus attack anyways.
Yeah, something like that. Or, yeah, well, there could be a lot of different ways to factor
stuff,
in. Yeah, exactly. Now, the other question is, can you just choose to not attack? Can you just use the Dimensional Assault but not use the free
attack?
Let's
look at the text again.
Teleport to any raid that's within range of a creature and then make a melee strike against one creature within your reach. Do you have to make that strike? It's interesting.
Yeah.
You want to use it to recharge spell strike, forego the free attack so that you don't have your map on the spell strike. Less attacks. It balances out, but the wording is kind of weird. It doesn't say, and then you may.
Yeah. And sometimes I feel like it does say that, whereas here, it doesn't seem like it's giving you that option.
It's interesting. I'd like to see what you guys say in the comments.
Yeah.
Throw it in the comments here. I'd love to poll the Naish here and see what you guys think on that one. Professor Eric's take is, admittedly, he says, not positive, but I think you can forego the strike and just use the jump ability. But he's not positive. So let's see what everybody
it might be a table thing, too. Like,
yeah,
you know, maybe I'd be an asshole and be like, sorry, got to take that strike.
Maybe. Anyway, So yeah. You got to take that strike. Anyway, it's an interesting thing. I sent this all off to Sydney, so good to know. Also, it's a good reminder for everybody in 2E. It's like, whenever a spell is one action, always look a little closer, because it's very possible that it is that it does not provoke. It's also possible, if it does provoke, because it's only somatic, that it's a good spell to have in mind for if you're deafened or if you can't speak for mm-hmm. any reason, right? If you're the victim of a silence spell or something. I don't know what silence is in 2E, but yeah, there you go. Anyway, fun stuff.
Sweet.
Okay, let's talk about the weapon potency rune. This is just going to bring up a brief conversation I want to talk about in terms of, treasure in general, just to give people an idea who are trying to GM or getting into GMing about how this kind of stuff works and why at the table I was like flabbergasted that she said she had a +1 katana. The reason is because when you start a new character at second level, you have, and this is right from Professor Eric, when you start a character at second level, the way the game sets it up is you should have one permanent first level item and 20 gold pieces to spend, or just 30 gold pieces to spend. Either option is fine. A +1 potency rune is 35 gold pieces and a second level item. So it is just out of reach if you're creating a character at second level. That's why I was baffled.
Right. And even at second level, you'd be walking around with a rune in your hand. You couldn't wear, like the weapon to put it on. You couldn't have,
right.
You'd have no money left.
You'd have no money left.
35.
You just walk around, throw the rune at
them. Did you know that like she's off by 5 gold, or it just didn't feel right to you?
No, I knew that she did not have the gold to buy. I didn't remember it was 5 exactly, but I knew that you can't afford it with the character gold, the starting character wealth of second level. So how she ended up getting it, it's just an error. It's just a simple clerical error. It's a mistake that we didn't catch. However, the interesting thing that Professor Eric points out is that I shouldn't be so baffled by a +1 potency rune being in the party. The way that this is all laid out, and actually, hold on, I have this up here. So the weapon potency rune, just for people that don't know, a weapon potency rune in 2E is just a rune that gives attack rolls a +1 item bonus. So it does not give you a bonus to damage, it just gives you a +1 to hit in 2E, which is nice, but it does cost 35 gold pieces, which would put it out of reach for Sydney creating a second level magus, to replace Lucky. However, the idea that it would be in here is not too crazy because of, let's do this, let's go here, because of treasure rewards. Now, this is from the GM core. Mm-hmm. The treasure rewards lays out the math behind this, which I find really, really interesting. It's basically, the simplest way to put it is that the game's math is based on the PCs looking to find, buy or craft items the same level as them. This includes weapon armor with fundamental runes. A PC who gets an item at that level, meaning their level, will typically be ahead of the monster's hazards and skill DCs briefly before their challenges start to catch back up. The way that Professor Eric lays this out is essentially, sometime between second level and third level, usually toward the end, by the way the game is balanced, GMs that are creating their AP or creating their adventures should plan on disseminating roughly, and there's a table here for you to use as a guide when you're GMing, should plan on disseminating roughly 2 third level items and 2 second level items to the entire party. Now, over the course of that entire level. So this is not per character. This is for the entire party. And it's also affected by how many PCs you have. So 5 PCs would change that as well, because having another PC is, I mean, it's almost like having an extremely powerful magical item, right? So you need to knock those numbers down a little bit when you have multiple, when you have over 4 PCs.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that GMs can do if they don't want to deal with something as complicated as, you know, what this looks like. So anyway, you could split out your level, your split out your items by level like this, or you could just have a budget. 70 gold pieces worth of treasure spread throughout an entire level of the game you're playing. From second to third level, you should dispense about 70 gold pieces worth of treasure. That could be in cash. It could be in items, however you want to do it. If there are no magic item shops or other ways to purchase items and formulas, make all the permanent core, In this case, it might work better for your game to use the automatic bonus progression system to eliminate the need for core items. That is how we do Quest for the Frozen Flame. Yeah. I don't know if you know about that.
But I do know.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that before. So that, I think, was a big relief to Jared because he doesn't have to think about placing treasure or something to make it fun or cool for us because, honestly, it's not really much in the AP. In fact, Professor Eric points out that this was a criticism among fans of the Quest for the Frozen Flame adventure path.
Yeah.
Was that it seemed like the authors forgot to put items in it because of its setting. It wasn't a setting that really a lot of magic items would be laying around.
Yeah, the reason I didn't use it is because I didn't feel that that was the case with Gatewalkers.
Right, totally. And so I guess the point of this whole conversation is if you're a GM, you're thinking about running your game, get that GM core. Dig into things like this because it is part of the game balance to disseminate a certain amount of treasure to keep your party not only up to snuff, but to occasionally pass their enemies for a little while and the DCs of their skill checks and stuff before coming back down to Earth within a short amount of time. And then the items catch up to them once again. So In summary, Asta could not have a +1 potency rune creating a character at second level. However, Professor Eric's opinion, based on this math that you see in these tables and these charts, he does the math a little bit better than I do. But the summary is we should probably have about 2 +1 potency runes in the whole party as of right now, as we're later into second level.
There's one that you guys missed already in the adventure, and it was just the way the story worked out. I don't know. I guess you guys, because you can remove runes from weapons and put it on yours, right?
Yes.
Do you know, can you think of what it could have been?
What it could have been? No.
Like in terms of like encounters.
So like encounters that we skipped or encounters that we didn't search bodies or encounters?
No, it was honestly, if you'd have to think of like what encounter could possibly have had an enemy that had a +1 weapon. What's been the big encounters thus far?
I don't know. Besides the centaur? You mean before we went into the...
Before, like in the entire adventure thus far, what's been
Bolon,
the...
Oh, Bolon.
Bolon. Do you remember what Matthew said? Throw your weapon over the edge. That was a +1 staff.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, very cool.
I was all right.
That's genius. Oh, yeah, that's great. Cool? When you do it to yourself, you do it to yourself. You
know? It's not crazy for one of you to have a +1 weapon. And it's not even that crazy for her to build it, but like she technically should not have been able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just brings up questions of like, how was she building the character? And that's what we just have to make sure of, because when inevitably there's another character death, we just want to make sure everybody is utilizing the wealth by level system and that's how they build. Because if you're going to bring in a fifth level character into this campaign, you better be coming in with magic items. You know what I mean? Or else it's going to be a bad, bad character. So like you need to have magic items, but you need to have magic items that fit, you know, your level. And that's what we got to work on. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that about wraps it up. Eric, thank you for all the detail you put into the math about, I mean, it is like, it's kind of hard to wrap my head around, but basically he says half to 3/4 of the party should have one potency rune or should have a rune by now. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at. And hopefully we start getting them soon. Would be nice. And even if we don't find them, we can always buy them.
I'm looking ahead to see if there's any coming up or. See the other ones that you may have missed. I mean, that's just so funny because I didn't really think about that until you started talking. I was like, wait a minute, Bolon had one. Oh, that's right. Matthew says, your weapon, throw it over the edge.
And we never checked it.
All right, see ya.
Well, oh my God. This is going to be like Baldur's Gate. I'm just going to go back and be like, we're going to go back to the gnome fortress and search the grounds underneath the area.
On the way back, can we just roll by the gnome fortress and do a quick search for a stick?
That's so amazing. Once again, we are running late, but I'm jamming in listener mail. Let's go. Let's get to this. We gotta talk to the Nash. We gotta hear the music. Nick twice in a row.
Oh, Nick Lowe. It's time to listen to mail. Gotta get your brain up on it. Time to listen to mail. Gotta keep
All right, going quick today. Paul from Tulsa. What's up, Paul from Tulsa? Is there any chance we could see more from the Good Enoughs? Dare we hope for a series? Wildly entertaining, like everything coming out of the GCN. Well, Paul, we're talking. We're talking.
We're on the horn with Disney every other day, trying to iron out these details. But yeah, I mean, there is various pitches have gone back and forth. It's something that both parties are super interested in. It's like anything else, just finding the right way to do it, to kind of maximize return for both of us. But we love working with them. I think they love working with us. And
that's,
so
that's what it seems like. So yeah,
we'd love to do more.
I think you could dare to hope. I'll say that. But yeah, lots of conversations to be had, and we would love to do more of that because, man, do I love that game. All right. AJ from High Point, North Carolina.
I think it's Aj.
Is it pronounced Aj?
That's how they say it, Aj.
Is that a North Carolina thing?
Uh-huh. Only in the Carolinas. Let me guess, A, capital J?
Capital A, capital J.
That's Aj.
No space between them.
That's a Carolina Aj.
That's a Carolina Aj. You know what? I'm sorry. I did this in the wrong order. I'm going to come back to Aj. I'll be right back to your question.
I'm going to come back to Aj.
I wanted to answer this one real quick because Aj is going to get a little more time. We're going to keep calling him Aj.
Aj.
I want to go to David. David is, I don't know if I have a place here.
You don't want to go to David.
I don't want to go to Dave. I don't want to say your last name if you don't want me to. So I'm not going to say it. David, you know who you are. Not sure if this is how to send questions. So crossing fingers. Well, you figured it out. This is how to send questions. All right. This is just a quick impossible landscapes question, which I like, which is just a fun sort of peek behind the screen GM thing. Early in Impossible Landscape season 4, Bobby got a phone call from unknown and using Star 69, he reached the New York Public Library. Over the course of the thing, this came up multiple times, and he wants to know, he's like, I gotta know, was the initial Star 69 improvised and then you dove into details between shows, or was it planned in advance beginning with the phone call? Just curious about the glass cannon process behind the scenes versus what is purely off the cuff. Well, I love that kind of question because that's the kind of stuff that I think about when I'm a player, you know, like, what, how did this, you know, come together? And it was not planned in advance. I had no idea you would Star 69, and the source of that phone call could have been a few different things, to be honest. But we went with New York Public Library, and that was improv'd. But it's also like, it's also the library, the bookstore, there are set pieces within New York, and most of them revolve around books in one way or another, that are great places to set King in Yellow type stuff. Mm-hmm. And they make this very clear in the book. And so all of these things in the book, the book has no, there is no order to the book. There is no like part one, part two, part three. I mean, there is in the grand scheme of the campaign, but like within each part, it does not build the way a Pathfinder AP does. So it is very much so like, here are all the things happening and you can use these in any order. The New York Public Library aspect was not something I expected to talk about or reveal at that moment. It just when Francis Starr 69, I was like, oh shit, like I got to actually come up with something here. And McDermott was like, NYPL, because we had talked about this. So like, all right, great. So I'll use that for now. And then it was between episodes that we really dug into setting something at the NYPL. So
that's anyway. So cool. People would be surprised. Like very few stuff is pre-planned.
Yeah.
And nothing was more evident than this past week's Time for Chaos when Ross like left fielded me. He was like, I want to make a phone call. And you know, if you've watched the episode, you'll know. And I was just like, why wasn't planning on playing this character right now? Okay. And it would end up turning into a really cool moment. But it's fun to do that, especially in these mysteries where you're like, wow, every little thing we say is important. How do we now take this improv and turn it into something? And
yeah,
That's really cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a perfect example of we turned it into something. The whole scene I thought was an awesome scene with Vicky doing the reading at the New York Public Library. That was all planned after that and largely motivated by that Star 69. So very cool, improv moment from you guys that ended up turning into a cool scene later down the line. All right. Back to Aj from High Point, North Carolina. What would happen if there was an unavoidable TPK in any of the ongoing shows, such as Glass Cannon Podcast, Time for Chaos, Legacy, etc.? How would you handle that for the show? This has been talked about a few times over the years, but I also think it is always relevant to return to and talk about because things change.
Yeah.
Some shows are different from each other. And I wonder this myself at times. So, let's just start with the big one, which is Gatewalkers. Right now, if we walked into a TPK, how do you envision that, being resolved?
You know, I always said in Giant Slayer, if there was a TPK, we'd just keep going. But like part of the conceit that we started in episode 100 is that like there are so many characters that make up this story that could take up the mantle. And it worked, you know, we had people die and other characters come back. It made for a nightmare trying to tie all those stories together at the end, but it allowed that campaign to never feel, it never felt forced when someone died and someone returned. It was just like, it was very natural. Now with Gatewalkers, there's so many Gatewalkers out there. You know, there's so many people who are looking to try and figure out what happened to them. And, you know, a large majority of them are under the care of Dr. Riddleston, who himself is trying to figure out what happened to them. So I think that it's sort of built into the adventure that you could very easily, even if everyone died, have a new party, come out. Now, just like, you know, I think of the end of Giant Slayer when you're on the fucking cloud castle, like, how do we get a PC in there? How do you get a relevant PC? Now, it already happened with Asta, but I know for a fact, like, there's going to be parts of this adventure where it'd be really, really difficult. We've always found a way before. I think that I would just keep it going as much as I'm like, I'd be excited to play something else, you know. I think with Strange Aeons, I could very easily like
that story ended in a TPK. It is, you know, it's an interesting concept. Like, I think Gatewalkers more than anyone that I've ever played in, I feel like, is more well suited to replacement parties. You know, like to me, it's the same. It's no different from Impossible Landscapes, for example. Now, Impossible Landscapes, you are too far in at this point. You know, in the event of a TPK in Impossible Landscapes, that will be the end of the story. But in most Delta Green things, it's built so that if the entire party dies, which is highly likely, like there is an organization that's sole purpose is to research what happened to that team.
Yeah.
And it creates the continuing of that story in a different way. Similarly, I feel like Gatewalkers has that same thing. You have a completely numberless amount of people that are Gatewalkers. There's no real number put on it.
Yeah.
It's not like this thing happened to these five people. It happened globally, right? And it's such a great conceit for you to like, there are so many more people that would be interested in solving this mystery beyond just the PCs. And so I think it's set up fantastically for that. Legacy of the Ancients, yeah. I don't know so much, right? I mean, Rise of the Runelords, it's like Strange Aeons. Like, what would happen in a let's go to Strange Aeons because you're the GM of that.
That's the one
what I was going to talk
about.
TPK there?
Well, this is very interesting, right? Because the way it works, you really want anytime there's a character death to happen, to have a character come back that was also one of Lowell's, like, people. Now, Matthew didn't want to do that with Sir Julie. And I was like, you sure? It would be better. And he didn't want to do it. I was like, that's fine.
So you killed her.
So I just killed her. But like, I just thought it would be better to have that happen. Now, after book three, after the end of book three, it's not that it doesn't really matter anymore. Cause I think that Aldo and Atticus's story is, they're the primary characters right now of the story. And that happens in every game. There are primary characters, there are secondary characters and whose stories are just important. But at this point, if both of them die, it's a very different story. Now, I think with the, the extras, as much as I want to finish this adventure path and finish as fast as possible, with all the extra vagaries of converting to second edition and now having to convert to the remaster, I don't know. I think if we had a TPK, I might be like, this is the clean slate I was looking for, and now I will just narrate what happens to the end of the world. I might actually consider that. Whereas I wouldn't do that with other shows. I think I would do it just from a logistics standpoint. I really want the tour to evolve into something else. And that might be the perfect excuse. Now, I'm not going to go out of my way to TPK.
No, but, for sure. But it's also set up in a way that it's really hard to replace the protagonists in that story with really new protagonists. Hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, you need at least, I mean, I think at this point, like if Atticus and Aldo died, we'd still be fine because we have Eris and Suki and Ethel, and now their story becomes the forefront. It's like they're finding new people to try and like finish this adventure in the name of their lost friends.
100%.
It's a totally different story.
We're talking about a TPK here.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about, a Baron dying, right? We're not talking about, you know, the last thread to the main story dying.
Yeah. Like, who are your allies right now? Who would be like, what? I haven't received a letter from Atticus in months. You know,
it's interesting, isn't it?
I'm an eighth level sorcerer that can come look for his body.
Yeah.
It's tricky, dude. Now, I know we could do it. You know, I already know your backup character, one of your backup characters.
Yeah.
You know, we could certainly make it work, but at a certain point, it might be like, you know what? The world got destroyed.
The universe is telling us something here. Let's just move. What about Time for Chaos? I mean, this is a weird one. You're very early in an extremely long campaign. You know,
we recorded two episodes last week, and then after we went off the air, I was like, man, I have no problem killing characters. It's pretty obvious. I love it. I think it's good for story, and I will be devastated when, not if, someone dies from this party, because I just love the characters so much, and I feel like removing one of them just changes everything. But also, yeah, how do you insert someone into this campaign? Now, the campaign is written in such a way where, like, you introduce NPCs, and it says right in the book, like, this would make a great replacement investigator. So, like, you could always just adopt one of these NPCs, but I know I would never want to do that. I always want to bring my original character.
Totally.
So I've already begun talking to one person in particular, being like, if anything ever happened, like, I had this idea, does this interest you? And so we're going back and forth just because I need to start preparing for these characters are going to fucking die. Like,
yeah,
it's going
inevitable.
To happen. So I need to prepare for that so it's not so ham-fisted into the adventure. It's tough though, with like a close knit group of investigators who are like, are investigating something because they're a close friend of theirs passed away and left them with this idea. Like, how do you bring someone else and have them all of a sudden be interested in that? It's a new headache that I'm not excited to have to deal with.
Well, great question, Aj. Thank you for bringing it up. It's good for us every once in a while to talk about these things. And I think we got some very clear, very good takeaways here, which is if there's a TPK in Strange Aeons, the tour is over.
That story is over.
That story is
maybe,
over.
Maybe. I and really want to get Chaos, to the end of it.
And Time for Chaos is the only show where Troy likes the character.
That's true.
Those are my takeaways. Thank you guys for writing in. If you want to hear your question answered on air, come on, write us at contact@glasscannonnetwork.com with your question, or go to the website. There's a portal through there. That's the one David used and said, not sure if this is how to send questions. You can go through there. I'm sorry. That was just through the website, but that worked. But anyway, you can go through the website, and also there's a listener mail specific section on the website where you can submit questions there. So write into us. Let us know. That's going to wrap it up. That's going to do it for the FOD this week. Good, buddy.
Boom. Early music.
I hate it. The old early music. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for hanging out, everybody. Check us out. Helldivers 2 stream today, 4 p.m. Eastern, twitch.tv/theglasscannon. And then, of course, we got Glass Cannon Podcast tomorrow night, YouTube premiere. Come hang out, watch it. Time for Chaos Friday night on YouTube. Lots of fun stuff happening. Man, next week, the whole show is just going to be about Toronto. We're going to speak Canadian in the whole next spot.
I'm going to learn it.
Yep. Yeah. All right. Bye, everybody. Take it easy. Have a good one. Later.
It's time to make your membership official. Become an official member of The Naish today at jointhenaish.com. That's jointhenaish.com, where you'll get access to exclusive podcasts and live streams you can't find anywhere else. See what everybody's talking about and join The Naish today at jointhenaish.com.